This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the theme of HIV and its relation with mental health, with someone who is at the forefront of activism around this topic, both in and out of drag. More on that later. For now, though, just a quick reminder of some of the information around HIV, given there continues to be such an ongoing stigma and lack of general understanding around this virus. So first off, the difference between AIDS and HIV, in case anyone needs a reminder. AIDS is the late stage of HIV infection that occurs when the body's immune system is badly damaged by the virus. The modern medication that is now available stops the development of HIV in its tracks and actually reverses the viral load in the body to such an extent that those who have had a diagnosis but are on effective treatment cannot transmit the virus to another person, which is so incredible. And the medications reduce the viral load to such an extent that if you were to take a test again, it wouldn't even show up as positive. The virus would be undetectable within the body. Also, a few quick stats from HIV Ireland. The most recent figures they've shared are for 2018, where there was 523 HIV diagnoses in Ireland, but the rate of diagnosis is on the increase. In 2018, that worked out at 11 per every 100,000 people in the population, of which 79% were male, 21% were female. Though it's worth noting the gender element of the statistics there was only included from the middle of 2018. So with that background in mind, I'm not going to give any spoilers about this conversation. I found it so moving, so uplifting, and our guest is so full of hope for how conversations around HIV and indeed mental health are developing in Ireland. And it's lovely to be able to relate where both of us are known for battling stigma and having conversations that are uncomfortable but are so vital. And this conversation will show how many ways these two topics can overlap. I said I wasn't going to give spoilers, but there's a bit of an outline. For now, though, we'll get into this conversation with Enda McGrattan, also known as Vader Lady, in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi, listeners. My name is Enda, and I'm in Dublin at the moment. And I guess I would consider myself to be a HIV activist and a podcaster. I'm one of the hosts of a podcast for people living with HIV. So I guess the first time that I came to terms with the fact that I was prone to bouts of depression, I was a teenager, and I was very much into that goth scene, obsessed with The Cure, wearing a lot of vintage clothes and makeup and really just loving that as a look. But I also was spending a lot of time, I grew up by the sea. I was spending a lot of time on my own by the water and increasingly just having this sinking feeling like that I wanted to throw myself in, until one day I actually did throw myself in. And lucky for me, there was someone else on the beach and he came running and I got myself back out of the water. But I don't really think of it as a suicide attempt, but I do think that it was just something that I had to get, like a demon that I had to get out of my system. So I'd been going to the beach the whole time and trying to figure out how to live, how to survive. And I guess the water just started to represent an escape route of some kind, you know? And it was kind of shocking to find myself walking home in the winter, wet and cold, and realizing that like living a happy life might be challenging from here out. I think there was the realization that my childhood was hard. When you're a kid and you're going through a difficult childhood, you have nothing to compare it to. and it's normality for you. But somewhere in my teens, I realized that, yeah, that I was having a hard time and it wasn't getting any easier. It was becoming a defining characteristic of who I was to be alone and be sad and to build up walls, not really trust people, not really let people in.
Yeah, I relate to that a lot, actually. And it's a heavy thing to carry and a heavy thing to realize at a young age how tough life can be. I really appreciate you sharing that anecdote about the sea, because, you know, that's something that I've felt, that there's those times where we can have maybe a vague suicidality, or what can be described as passive suicidal ideation is the technical term, where it's not necessarily as strong as making a clear plan, but it is a thinking about what it would be like if you weren't here, or what that kind of that experience would be to end things in a way. And when you look back on that, it sounds a bit like a thought that you couldn't escape from, but I don't necessarily want to commit to all the results that might mean.
Yeah, exactly. I grew up by the sea and I'm a fairly strong swimmer, but it was winter. It was very rough. It was very cold. And I went to a place called High Rock. So though there was a bit of a like of a jump involved, like a bit of a performance, really, where I had to build myself up to it and then do it. And I do think that it was just a way to express how I felt for myself, to myself. I don't think it was really ever an attempt to end my life, but I think it was an attempt to maybe jolt myself out of something, you know, get over this hump, this obsession, this time spent alone, staring at the sea, wondering if you're going to be okay, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like a physical way to tackle those feelings that you didn't know what to do. And you're like, is there something I can do with my body to confront this? And
yeah.
I'm definitely prone to those moments that people don't always understand and can seem dramatic. Like I'm reminded of a very different situation, but a breakup I once had where I walked an hour home in the cold after that conversation, and it felt appropriate to the emotions I was feeling. You know, it was a way
yeah.
to process it, and a way it was almost like that movie scene where something goes bad and then it starts raining and you're like, oh yes, this feels correct.
And you know, it's funny, I didn't tell anybody about it until I was like, you know, a good 30 years later. I'm telling you about it now. This is very rare for me to really ever talk about it or own it. But when we spoke earlier about mental health, I thought, when did I first acknowledge to myself that I wasn't experiencing the same mental health that a lot of the people were? And I guess then threading those things together, the reasons why you end up in that position was very painful too, you know, because at that stage I was a queer teenager, but I wasn't out to anybody, even myself. I now would say that I was trans, now that I know better, that's what I would say. But at the time, that didn't seem like even a possibility. I felt like totally alone, because I think when you're non-binary, you know that you don't want to transition, but you know that you're not what people label you as too, you know? And in the 80s and early 90s, there was no language for that. Even more recently, there was no language for that. I have very close, very good trans friends, trans women. And the way that we talked about it and to each other has even changed very recently in recent years. Now that having conversations about non-binary gender and people choosing different pronouns has become a conversation that we can have, I can sit with my trans women friends and we all understand each other. And we're just telling the truth. It just is our truth. It's always been our truth. Nothing in our relationship changed except the understanding. And we're talking about people whose understanding of gender would be very, very sophisticated and evolved. But even with those people, it's very recent. It's a very new thing for trans to have this broader.
Yeah, to be that umbrella term.
Yeah. Like, I used to feel like I was outside of the umbrella sometimes and here getting wet on my own, and other times I'm allowed in, you know. But now the umbrella just got broader. So I feel like I can be around the edge and I can still be under there with everybody else.
Yeah, it is such a difficult conversation to navigate if you don't have the language and if you don't have the role models and you're feeling that experience of, I may never live up to people's expectations of me, whether that's sexuality-wise, gender-wise, career. There can be a lot of that put on us from a young age. And you've got that experience of looking into the future and being like, I don't know if I see myself there. I don't know where I fit. And then also you're in a situation with your depression where you feel so out of place and so that you don't fit in the current moment either. It's a lot. It's a lot to carry.
Yes, totally. And I guess I was like threading all of the pieces together of being like a camp, effeminate, trans kid in a very normal, suburban, working class family and being wrong all the time, you know, speaking the wrong way, standing the wrong way, walking the wrong way, and just constantly being fed that message by parents who I love and who loved me. But, you know, they just didn't know how to deal with it. And they both seemed to think that changing me was the answer. And if you're a small kid being constantly fed this message that you need to be different, by the time you get into your teens, it's like all you want to do is be yourself. It becomes everything to you. And it's a funny one because that teenager on the beach could never have imagined Beta, my drag character, and everything that came later. Mm-hmm. He never could have imagined it. But I think that spirit, that fire, was there already. I think it was one of those defining moments when it was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to get away. I'm going to have to fight. I'm going to have to live differently to everybody else because I can't live like this and I can't stay here. And it took me years to move away from home, but I think I started to move away in different ways already then, you know. I developed like a secretive side, a more secretive side, and an ambition to find queer people, an ambition to get away from a small seaside town and go somewhere where I actually wanted so little. I wanted so little. I just wanted a bed sit in the center of the city, you know, a room that was my own, where I could put any posters I wanted on the walls, where I could hang whatever clothes I wanted in the closet. Just simple things, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is it. You can't change who somebody is. And I think sometimes actually it goes the other way, that the more you try and suppress somebody's identity, the more that craving grows and the more you might feel that urge to really fly in the face of those expectations. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that many drag queens come from certain backgrounds that were very restrictive or where religion was used in a very oppressive way against them or their identity. And then you find years later, it's almost balanced out by, oh, now I'm going to be the queerest and I'm going to be that icon and I'm going to be that representation that I needed all those years ago.
Yes, like I have never really had a proper job. I don't have a CV and I really struggle to take direction. I have really more come from a collaborative place and commit to that relationship to make that work, you know, as an artist really, or as a performer, because of all of that stuff from my childhood. I just do not like anybody telling me what to do in any situation. And it's made me very resourceful. It's made me like a reluctant entrepreneur. And it's meant that, you know, I've had quite a good cabaret career because I've never had any other career. Nothing's really distracted me from my creativity. And that in itself, I think, is such an amazing accomplishment. That gives me real pride. And I think that comes from the fact that that is all part of my survival. That is that kid. Everything that I wasn't allowed to do is all I do now. And if anyone tries to tell me what to do, especially men, it can be to my own detriment, but it's still something I'm proud of, you know?
Yeah, no, I get that. And if we may trace back a little bit to before you had any kind of understanding or language around your gender identity, what was that coming out experience like in terms of sexuality? And what was the relationship like there with where your mental health was at the time?
It was really difficult, my coming out experience. Super fun in lots of ways too. I met some amazing queer people when I went to college and started to experience queer nightlife and had my first boyfriend and had sex for the first time. And all of these things that were very sweet, fun happened. But in terms of my relationship with my family, it was like devastating. Unfortunately, my late father handled it really badly and got physical about it. And things really broke down between me and them for a while. I'd say we had a good 10 years of struggle before we got into a good place. We both worked at it all that time, but from a distance. And it was hard. It was hard. It was such a fall from grace as well for me because I was quite spoiled. I grew up in a nice neighborhood and I had things kind of easy in a way. And then I was just out of the house and on my own and I had to just make it work, survive, you know? Yeah. It was hard. It was a struggle. I think that ultimately, as I got a little bit more, like closer to my full bloom adulthood, I became slowly more empowered because I met some amazing people. I had a really, really close friend at the time, and we're still friends, a girlfriend who had a gay brother who she was very close to, who was a little older than us. So she took one look at me and was like, oh, there's a gay. And she would send me signals all the time of encouragement. And she would talk as well a lot about queer stuff in a positive way around our friends. And that really helped me a lot. So when I started to come out to my friends like her, I felt so much better. And depression became less of a feature and excitement. And I stepped in. And I started to club a lot. I got really into dressing up a lot. And having that side of myself, that showy side, that confident side, was brand new to me because before that, I was the sheepish kind of sweet kid, but really didn't want to draw attention to myself at all. And all of a sudden, I was like this hot club kid who was dressed to the nines. And I really enjoyed that change. It was really good for me.
It's great to hear, and it's lovely when you have experiences like with that friend. Am I right in kind of intuiting from what you described there that rather than her being like, oh, I think I know this thing about you, you can tell me, it was more kind of subtle and respectful of, oh, I'm going to show that I'm an ally and then you'll feel comfortable to tell me in your own time.
Yes, exactly that. She was like, Naomi is her name. She was like wise beyond her years in that way. And she didn't really discuss it with anybody else. Either speculate, she just sort of led me in, introduced me to her, you know, had those conversations and was just always supportive of everything that I wanted to do, especially dress up and be glam. It's like Naomi told me I was cool, so then other people thought I was too, you know?
Yeah, and also sometimes I think it's prompting us to believe it, that if we can learn to own those parts of ourselves proudly, then people are like, well, I guess they are cool, seemingly.
Yeah, it's like I believed it for enough anyway to go with it. And then in no time, I was like hosting clubs and doing the door at clubs and stuff like that. It was like I created this character and people just bought into it. Before I did drag, I mean, my name is Enda McGrattan. That's my family name. But I invented this character when I was in college called Enda Story. And within no time, I was writing a column for the Sunday Independent, which is the biggest Sunday newspaper. So I was the first out queer columnist in the country, not just in the newspaper, which was very cool. And Enda Story was my pen name, which was just because I wanted to have an independence really from my family, not because I wanted to protect them from the scandal or anything, but just because I felt like I needed to step away at that time because they weren't really supportive of my queerness at all. And things had just gotten hard there. But at the same time, these opportunities started to happen because I was living in my own skin for the first time and putting myself out there. And they were kind of funnily enough, big opportunities. So that was remarkable, you know?
And when I look back, impressive.
Yeah, it's like I went from, you know, living on Ben Burb Street, which is where the hookers were working in the street at the time, in this semi-squat with my mates, to writing for the newspaper and hosting the hottest new club in town. It was the Pod at the time. Yeah, within just a year, maybe, within a few months, which was remarkable. Yes. I think it took a while for the initial buzz, the glow of being a new queer on the scene to wear off, and a few negative queer experiences, like getting your heart broken or being taken advantage of sexually as well by people who are more sophisticated than you, especially when it comes to things like drugs and partying. Before I experienced my first real queer depressions, I'm going to call them, where it wasn't because I'm stuck and because I can't come out of the closet or because I don't have power. It's like, okay, well, I now have all those things that I wanted, but I'm still depressed. That felt like a real kick in the teeth.
Yeah. No, I get that. Depression now with glitter.
Depression doesn't care how far you've come. It's still there. It's still coming for you.
Yeah.
Still to this day.
Yeah. No, I have a guest I interviewed previously that would describe it as like the whistle of a train in the distance, that it's not necessarily gone. She's just better at gauging how far off it is at any point.
I love that. Yeah.
And that must have been an interesting time for you to both be sort of coming down off the high and the excitement of discovering so much more of who you are and finding a tribe in that, and having these kind of feelings of depression come back. And the way you describe it, it sort of sounds quite reflective of Irish culture at the time, where in many ways the approach by the government and certain laws haven't kept up pace with how attitudes in Ireland have evolved towards queerness. And am I right in remembering that when you came out originally, it was illegal to be gay?
Yeah, that's right. It was before, it was while you could still be criminally prosecuted and even imprisoned for being gay, just about.
And yet you were getting this, you know, this massive opportunity with a column read by so much of the country.
Yes, exactly. And the first couple of times I did drag in San Francisco in like 96, 97, I was still writing for the newspaper. So I wrote about that in the Sunday Independent, and they put in pictures of me in drag in San Francisco, which now looking back, I mean, it's pretty wild too, because now it's just become so normal and popular, and rightly so. But then it was still really juicy. You know, that the paper we want to write about it. And a lot of my friends and friends' families weren't supportive of it, didn't think it was a good idea. They didn't really care that I did drag, but they did care that it was in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not acceptable at the time. There was still a lot of shame associated. And it's amazing how much it's changed. And I feel somewhat responsible sometimes. Myself and Panty and Shirley, my sisters, now you can't swing a cat without hitting a drag queen. But it was very brave, and it was very stigmatizing too. And it was loads of fun, and I wouldn't have it any other way. But now when we talk about queerness and drag in Dublin, I think only in recent years I've started to be able to give myself a little bit of the credit, give us a bit of the credit, because in the time that we've been doing what we do, so much change has happened. And I guess we're the pioneers. I have to accept now that I'm also an elder stateswoman of drag, that I was also a pioneer.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. If you won't claim it, I'll claim it for you, because I totally agree with that. And if you, you know, look at the queens that you've mentioned there, you know, Panty has become such a fixture of kind of television and popular culture, and many people credit her as one of the most significant figures in the marriage equality referendum, for example. And now she's on Dancing with the Stars.
Did you see? Myself and Shirley were on.
You got on with her. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Shirley used to host Bingo in full drag years ago.
Yeah, on TV.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's things like that I guess the kids don't know now. And lots of things that we did over the years, appearances and TV gigs and whatever, that really helped to make those changes in this country. I know that. And Bingo and the George, like, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people must have come across the doors now and seen us perform. I started my show in the George and Wednesday Nights in 1999, you know, over two decades ago. So,
and now most of your audience probably wasn't even born then.
Yes, a lot of them weren't, which is really fun. You know, they say, how young would you date? That should be mine. It should be like, if you were born after I started my show in the shorts.
I think that would be a good yardstick. I love that. I think you're so right. There's so much to be said for representation. And, you know, between this handful of queens, you really for a long time were the representation. And in terms of them through this time, you're finding all these different incredible opportunities. You're establishing yourself as an icon in the drag scene. And how were things for you behind the scenes, you know, over the coming years?
I had so much fun in my 20s and my 30s partying and going to raves and clubs and meeting amazing people. And it was a roller coaster for my mental health. But I was pretty tenacious and I held on with both hands. So I guess it was a lot of highs and lows, but in the way that, you know, ravers have them, where all your highs are, you know, 4 days of the week and your lows are the other 3 days. And it went on like that for years. And to be honest, that was quite manageable because you knew the pattern and it was like up and down, like a heartbeat on a monitor, and it was steady. And I think it actually became more of an issue. Depression became more of an issue when I eased off the partying and started to become more reclusive and a bit more isolated, because then it wasn't like a heartbeat up and down anymore. It was a much slower, steady decline and more of a struggle to get back up again. Because I didn't have the serotonin and the clubbing and the glamour and the casual sex, you know? So I think that my deepest depressions didn't come into my life until around the time of my father's death, which was in 2006. It was prior to my HIV diagnosis. And it, in a way, I think, led to my HIV diagnosis. I became very depressed and stopped taking good care of myself and making worse choices than ever. Not that, you know, having sex and getting an STI is a worse choice. Not that getting HIV is a problem. But that is how it was going for me. That's how it was, where I ended up being with people who I didn't really know very well, who I didn't really trust, and getting into toxic relationship, very codependent, messy relationships. And yeah, I think that that is when I started to really struggle. But actually, I feel like I skipped an important part of the story, because I guess I fell in love at the age of 29 with a complicated guy. He's an artist and bisexual and rootless, as in had no roots, not ruthless.
Okay.
You know, he just the shirt on his back, really, some nice designer clothes and, you know, and no friends or family really here. His name was Ryan, and I fell head over heels in love with him. And he did too. We had a very special bond, but he had a serious drug problem, which ultimately several years later led to his early demise. And there was a time in our relationship where I realized that I would be next, or I would be right there with him if I didn't get away from him. And it was the depression that made me worry, that made me know that. I felt like, this is fine right now because you're doing okay right now. But if you become depressed and vulnerable, are you going to end up doing the same drugs that he's doing? There were a couple of times that he spiked me as well that really scared me. And yeah, and that was a really hard time. But the worst of it was after we broke up, because I was so in love with him. And it was maybe my first real broken heart, mm-hmm. that the kind that's very hard to recover from, maybe that you never recover from, you know? I still feel so much love for him now and so much loss for him now. And after that, I experienced some really bad depressions.
Yeah,
well, that's... And I feel like they cost me a lot in terms of my work. And they cost me a lot in terms of my friendships because I just wasn't in a good place. I mean, you're not in a good place. Being a good friend or being a good collaborator can be very difficult. And I think now we have better understanding of that and you feel like you could maybe say it. Now, if I'm in an email thread that's doing my head in, I tend to just say, this is doing my head in. you know what I mean? Or say what I have to say and be real about it. But then I couldn't professionally. It wasn't a done thing to say I'm struggling or this is hard for me. And with my friends, I think I had exhausted their patience because when you have a really messy, toxic relationship and people are constantly telling you to get out of it for your own safety and for your own good, and that goes on for a year of that, and then you have the breakup and then you have the fallout, they're just kind of sick of it. Nobody really wants to hear about it anymore. And
you're coming to them telling them, so it turns out this relationship was unhealthy, and they're like, yes, we knew this, tell us something new. But yeah. You're right, it is very tough to be in that position where there is an understandable grief there and yet also an acknowledgement that it was unhealthy. You know, it happens all the time. We fall in love with people that we shouldn't, particularly if we're young, particularly if we've been in some ways denied the experience of kind of having those first, maybe safer love options. And sometimes the oppression of queerness can be part of the reasoning there. You know, to then try and unpack all of that whilst also navigating depression. You reminded me of a comedian I love and who I've interviewed called Laura Lex, who sometimes describes her depression as inside every silence. And it made me think of that when you described, you know, it would pop up in the times when you weren't flat out performing or the times when you weren't distracted by navigating this relationship and all its highs and lows, when you were sat in your own space, it was still there in your ear being like, I've not gone away, you know?
Oh gosh, it's me all over. You know, that is me to a T. My sister passed away in April of last year. And a few weeks after that, I put my dog to sleep after 15 and a half years. And my sister had given me my dog. My sister Tara had given me my baby, Ziggy. And I lost them both quite close together and very surprisingly, quite quickly. And I worked my ass off from then until New Year's Eve. We were doing our podcast, Robbie and I. We were doing promotion for How to Tell a Secret, the film that we collaborated with Invisible Thread to make. And we were doing all kinds of other talks and activism, as well as me doing all of my drag. And my conscious decision was to throw myself into the work. Mm-hmm. I knew I was moving away from the grief, but it felt like the practical way to deal with it. I kept that up until World AIDS Day. The momentum of HIV-related work up to and around World AIDS Day was huge. And then I went straight into a drag Christmas. And Christmas in the gay bars and in the drag world is also a super busy time. So by the time I got to New Year's Eve, burnt out is the only way I could describe how I felt. And I'm really only starting to crawl out of that now in the last few days. And it's still not easy. It's very, very hard some days. What has changed and what is better is that I'm much better at talking about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like much better.
Yeah, no, that helps. And I think, you know, sometimes as a performer, you particularly need to have that skill maybe more because there can be this kind of, again, narrow expectation of people see you being the life and soul of the party and assuming, okay, well, that must be you 24/7. Maybe you're not always in the drag, maybe you're not always on stage, but you must have that energy and that lust for life all the time. And, you know, that's so often not the case with performers as it is with anyone.
And one of the things I think is quite fun for me and about me is that on Wednesday nights at my show every week, I always tell the audience, especially the regulars, what's going on with me in a very honest and deadpan way. So I talk about grief sometimes. I talk about depression as well. And we have a really good laugh about those things. It always works to reframe it, make it funny, but be honest and express it. And it's something I really look forward to. And I know that not all performers do that. I understand why, but I think when you have a little witchy show in the middle of the week on a Wednesday night in a gay bar, you have license to do that. But I also feel like we all go through it, especially grief or ill health, but nobody wants to own up to them publicly. People can really struggle to say that socially, you know?
Yeah. Or there's, you know, there's that pressure that goes along with the stigma of save it till you're better. Talk about these things in hindsight, because that'll be kind of less confronting for people, easier to swallow. But I think it's actually less relatable. You know, I think particularly those in the public eye, being honest about being in a difficult spot, I think would connect with people a lot more than this kind of narrative I think people are encouraged to have of, like, you know, wait till you write the memoir. Then you put in all the real shit, but then it gets the happy kind of neatly tied together ending of now you're rich and famous and everything's okay. And I think more and more in culture, we're waking up to there's not a happily ever after in Disney, and there's not a happily ever after in celebrity either.
Yeah.
And talking about stigma, we've touched a bit on stigma in terms of sexuality. Would you mind sharing your experiences around HIV and that first diagnosis?
Sure, and I don't mind at all. From the time of diagnosis until 2019, I was in the HIV closet. And it was not the nicest place to be. And it started off very simply because I came home from the doctor and told my then boyfriend what was going on. And he freaked out, but asked me to tell no one. And so for a few days, I didn't tell a soul. And then for a few weeks after that, I think I told my closest friend at that time. And then for a few weeks after that, I thought that I would come out soon, just not right now. Mm-hmm. But that deadline just kept getting pushed back and pushed back until I'd say about a year after diagnosis, I realized that I was not coming out of the closet at all to pretty much anyone. And for the next 10 years, I maybe told a friend once a year, someone I really trusted. So over the course of 10 years, maybe there was 8 people that I had ever come out to. And everything to do with HIV, I kept on the down low. I didn't go to the normal channels in James's hospital or in Vincent's hospital. I got my own private doctor and I started to do it that way. And I just sort of painted myself into this corner because of shame and stigma, really. I grew up in the Rock Hudson generation. You know, I was a child in the 80s. In 1981, I was 9 years old and I was obsessed with Hollywood and Rock Hudson already, obsessed with Elizabeth Taylor and Doris Day. And so I really was traumatized by AIDS as a queer kid. And then all through my teens and in school, when I was being bullied, I was being accused of having AIDS all the time. I never even had sex, but it was just what the kids used at the time to bully camp kids, was to say they had AIDS or had given someone AIDS or were going to die of AIDS. So I understand now, looking back, why I made the choices that I made. I was stigmatizing myself more than anybody else was stigmatizing me about the fact that I had effed up and become HIV positive. Also, the world's changed an awful lot since then. You know, we didn't have equal marriage then, and we didn't have a lot of conversations, that positive, affirming conversations with our families, with our communities, with our government. We were still very much, you know, the outsiders, the underdogs. And yeah, so I didn't tell anybody about it, but luckily along the way, I met and fell in love with my husband, Leo. And when I told him about it, his reaction was pretty amazing because he's 15 years younger than me. He's from Brazil. He's quite super smart and quite experienced. And when I came out to him about my status, that wasn't the first time that someone had done that with him. And he knew exactly what to say and how to handle it. And I think that was a key to unlocking an ambition in me to come out more publicly, you know?
Yeah, it was that little bit of hope that the positive reaction is out there. Do you remember what it was he did say?
He said, I guess that's what you were about to say. And that's totally cool. And I said, what do you mean you guessed that I was about to say? And he said, you've been using the word positive a lot. And you've used it 3 times since we sat down.
Oh,
you were positive that you wanted the pasta, for example. You know what I mean?
That's very sweet, though, that speaks to a very attentive partner.
Yeah, and that was it. That was as big a deal as it was. You know, he knew about you equals you. He knew that I wasn't going to die and that neither was he and that everything was fine. And yeah, like, it's really great. And that became, you know, the key, like I said, to things changing. There was that I felt a lot of guilt a lot of the time because I'm very active in the community and involved in activism in lots of different ways. And I've been involved in lots of campaigns that I've been really proud of, but I had been in the closet about HIV and I hadn't done anything for people living with HIV. So my growing ambition was to do something and make it really honest and be really vulnerable and do it in the most public way that I could muster. A minor V-list celebrity like me could muster. So ultimately, I ended up writing a song called I Came Out One Night. It's a pretty beautiful song, even if I say so myself. And I decided I was going to use the song to come out. I didn't tell anybody at all. I made a video, music video, everybody in it. I loved them to bits. So I didn't tell any of them what I was doing. Even the director, Joe, who made the video, didn't know until the very end what the purpose of the video was and what the song was really about. I mean, 2 days before I put it online, I told him for the first time. But it wasn't because of shame or fear. Something had changed. It was because of ambition, and not ambition to have a hit or become famous, but ambition to really break stigma, to really help destroy stigma. And I felt like the less people that knew, the more power coming out like that would have. That came at a price, I have to say, but it was worth it. So I released the video on World AIDS Day 2019, and I went to Vienna to visit friends. My friend Justin Vivian Bond was in the opera in Vienna. So I went to HIVienna, I like to say, to get out of town. But that's how I came out about my status. And people were super supportive, especially online. It was an awful lot of shares, reshares, tweets, positive statements. And the song started to go up the charts online. And you know, and I really felt great about it and about my decision. And that, I guess that watershed moment just sort of changed my life, really, because a couple of months later, we're in lockdown because of COVID. COVID arrives in 2020, just after I freed myself from the HIV closet. I ended up locked in the house anyway. And that gave me time to really reflect about what was going to be next for me and what I wanted to do next. And really, the answer was something to do with HIV, something to support people who are living with HIV, something to destroy stigma. And I think we all know what came next, which was, you know, my podcast with Robbie and I Had to Tell a Secret, the documentary, and lots of other stuff that we do. I could go on and on and on. All came from that first 1 year of lockdown.
Yeah. I love to hear this story because I relate to it so much that whilst I don't have HIV myself, there's a lot of your approach to coming out about it that, you know, I can so understand the position you were in. You know, I think we can all come across the stigma so much. There's people that have no firsthand experience of it, but want to be an ally, but the stigma might hold them back. They might just change the subject and not realize why they did that.
Absolutely. When you talk about HIV and people living with HIV, unfortunately, the vast majority of us are in the closet. So the people who are talking the most are just a handful of us who are out. It can feel like a lot of responsibility, but it also is a real honor to be able to speak for the community and have the support of the community. It's really amazing. But the stigma is still super real. So I completely understand how I ended up in a closet. I fully understand why they are. And coming out of the closet isn't for everyone. And I don't ever want people to think that I would pressurize them into doing it. But what I will say is it's been transformative for my mental health and my life. and I feel so much better. So I think that would be the case for a lot of them. But not everybody's in that position. It is a privileged position to be in. And some people, the circumstances that they're in would not allow them to come out about their status without them paying a very high price for that. It's a difficult one. And then when you're in the closet living with HIV, you experience all kinds of stigma that you would never experience if you were out about it. And sometimes I think I experience a lot more stigma in the closet than I do out, because people won't say anything to you out if they know that you're living with HIV. They won't say stupid stuff. But if they don't know, they will. Believe me, they will. They'll say stupid stuff about HIV or AIDS. They'll say AIDS a lot more than they would say HIV. And talk poorly about people who are living with HIV and slut shame them or, you know, imply things about them. I experienced lots of that. I heard loads of that, unfortunately, over the 10 years that I was in the closet. And yeah, so it's a very real thing. Some of the fears that people have about coming out, I can't say, oh, you know, they're not real or you're going to be fine. They're very real. I understand it. I've heard it myself with my own 2 ears. But things have changed remarkably in recent years. And things will change even more every time someone comes out about their status. Because we're fun, we're sexy, we're happy, just like living our lives, you know?
I appreciate you sharing all of that. And, you know, it's very clear to me from, you know, what you've shared there, that the positive impact it had for your mental health. And I don't know you well enough to say this, but even just hearing, you know, you share this today, I feel very proud of what you overcame with that.
Thank you so much. What's been sweet about it was when we were in lockdown and I was feeling pretty good about things, despite not working and being in lockdown and worrying about people and the state of the world, I felt pretty good within myself because I wasn't living with that toxic secret anymore. And it also drew people to me that I never would have understood how it would work if it hadn't been for lockdown, because more and more people were tuning into everything that I was doing online. And I was getting more and more messages from people living with HIV. And that was a clear indicator to me that I had some kind of calling or agency or something that I could do with this, that I can make change with this. That a lot of the time, I think when you're an artist, you're creating something for yourself and it's quite a lonely process. But I guess the difference between being an artist and being an artivist, shall we say, a creative activist, is that you really aren't creating something for yourself. You're trying to create change for everybody. And that's a really hard thing to do on your own. But I felt very fortunate that I already knew that I had that support, enough at least to get the ball rolling. It's really just got to do with the community, not just people living with HIV, but the queer community above and beyond. We have some straight allies too, of course, but the queer community really embraced everything that we've done and everything that I've done in relation to HIV. I think it was that thing that was all in plain sight where everybody could see it, but nobody was looking at it, at HIV stigma, where none of us had really ever bothered to try to dismantle it until COVID came along and everybody is locked in their house because of a virus. And everybody suddenly understands stigma associated with getting it. And everybody understands the judgment that's placed on you or how people can react badly towards thinking that you have a virus. And for me, that was like, that was gold dust. That was my golden opportunity. That's what really got the ball rolling, you know?
Oh, yeah. I'd not thought about it in that way. And I think you're spot on. And, you know, we had 2 years of people to various levels feeling that, you know, they couldn't cough in public because how they would instantly be judged. And it was a very reflective time, you know, being stuck inside for so many of us with our thoughts, considering the state of the world, considering oppression of various groups. You know, it sounds like, as you described there, there was that void. That conversation so needed to happen, and, you know, but it needed someone to kind of kick it off, and you got to be that person.
We got to do it by doing what you're doing now. We got to do it by putting microphones in other people's hands and putting microphones in front of other people. And that's one of the things that I love the most about what we do, is that we collect stories from people living with HIV and we build real friendships with them. God knows they drive me crazy. We build community together. And it's not about Robbie and I or our story, or it's not about calling out people for poor behavior or stigma or treating us badly. It's really just about pointing out the bleeding obvious. And COVID made that really possible.
Yeah.
To just be able to say, you know, can we just draw a line under all of this bullshit here? Because you equals you, which means that we people living with HIV could not give you HIV if we were to have sex. So us being shamed or slut shamed or undesirable, labeled undesirable, it just makes absolutely no sense anymore for you to believe that now that we've all experienced an epidemic, a pandemic, how a virus operates. A virus doesn't care if you're a slut or a nun. A virus, just a virus, you know?
And before we start to wrap up then, could we delve into that a little bit more? Because we've talked about how, you know, the stigma has changed and in various ways lessened, thank God. And along the same timeline, so has the medication improved. So if people are a bit unfamiliar, you know, you kind of gave an idea of you equals you there. Could you share a bit about how medication has evolved, both in terms of if you have the HIV virus, but also preventative medication?
Sure. HIV medication these days is so great. It's really come a long way. You know, they're very palatable and easy on you and easy on the stomach. And, you know, they don't really upset me anyway at all. Compared to the type that I was on before that, Atripla, which really messed with my head in so many ways. And it was difficult to sleep. And I have a lot of night sweats and feel nauseous all the time. And that was just normal for years while I took that drug. That was the price you paid to stay alive. But the good news is the medications that we have now don't feel anything like that. They're so much better. So if you are living with HIV and you're on an older medication like an Atripla, you need to get in and see your doctor and upgrade your medication. Because believe it or not, there's still plenty of people walking around this city on those old meds, even though much better new meds are available, just because their doctors didn't ever bother to tell them or change them, which is mind-blowing. But anyway, what U equals U means that once you're on one of these fabulous tic-tac medications and you become undetectable, that means that the viral load in your body is so small that it's undetectable, can't find it at all. It's there, but you can't find it. Once that happens, you can't pass on HIV to anyone else, either by having sex or by giving birth to them. Have a baby and your baby would not be HIV positive. So that's really what being undetectable means. And it's a game changer for people living with HIV because through stigma, our own and the stigma that society has placed on us, we have been thought of as being undesirable or dangerous sexually. When now the irony is we are the safest people to have sex with because we know our status and we know we can't give you HIV. You can't necessarily say that about any other lover that you might take today. Unless they were tested today, you know, how would they know? And how would you know? So in that way, it's a game changer for us. The other option, though, if you're not living with HIV, is to take a drug called PrEP, which is a drug that you can take either daily or you can take it for events, as in take it a couple of days before you're planning on having a little or a lot of sex, and it will prevent you from becoming HIV positive. Yeah, and PrEP is freely available on the HSC. It's been a problem to be able to actually access it, even though it's freely available. But I believe that this year it's going to get a lot easier. And that's simply because the HSC and the government totally underestimated the demand that will be out there. So many people want to take it. And it's difficult now to get an appointment to be put on a PrEP program. But you can go to your own GP and do it through your own GP, which means you're going to have to spend a little bit of money, but it means you're going to have it right away. So my advice would be know your status, most importantly. And if you're HIV negative, get some PrEP. HIV numbers are on the rise. They've never been higher than they are in this country. They have been increasing at a dramatic rate in the last 12 months. And so it's shocking how many this year because we have the tools to.
Yeah, well, this is the wonderful thing that it is so preventable now. And, you know, if this medication was around for other things, like if I could take something a day to make sure I never have diabetes, for example, I'd absolutely be on that one, right? There's so many things we would take in the pandemic if there was, you know, if we caught COVID and there's something we could take every day and then go back out and not have to isolate, we'd be on it immediately, you know? So it's like you say, it's getting the information out there. And, you know, I'm so glad to have this conversation because the thing that worries me about it is that, yes, absolutely, cases are on the rise. They're still, you know, it's still not a common experience by any means to get HIV. But I think it can be exacerbated, people thinking it's a thing of the past, which it's not. And part of that is the stigma. And so in many ways, you know, I think where we're at the moment, it is not an overestimation to say that it is often the stigma that is killing people. It's people not getting tested, people not getting medication, people not even knowing that these options are out there. That seems to be the larger threat now that the treatment is so effective.
There are so many things that need to be done, you know, nationally by the government, by the HSC, by HIV Ireland and other organizations whose job it is to do these things. What Robbie and I do is off our own backs and voluntary. And I think we've done a pretty amazing job in getting the U equals U message out there as far and wide as we have. But I think that the most important thing we can do is have the conversations. You know, the stigma is right here on the tip of our tongues. That's where the problem is. We don't open our mouths and just say it. It's okay to say, I'm HIV negative. You know, I'm not on PrEP. Or I'm HIV negative and I'm on PrEP. And I mean, say it to someone's face, don't say it in an app or say it in a text message. Especially it's hard. It can feel hard as someone living with HIV to tell people in that environment that you are. But in my experience, it gets me laid more often than not.
Yeah, being safe, being good with your sexual health, real sexy.
Yeah, and just being able to say it and be honest about it and say I'm undetectable and this is where I'm at. I have had way more positive experiences than negative. And if I go online, this is shocking, but if I go online on Grindr for any amount of time, you know, like the amount of pause guys that will hit me up, it's remarkable. And I don't go on the app all that often. And mostly that's why, because it can become a bit overwhelming. You know, it's like a part-time job just to answer these people. And some of them are looking for sex, but a lot of them are just want to interact with someone else who's paused and says so openly on Grindr, you know? And I think it's amazing that we can do it there on the app. But what really needs to change is be able to do it in the club, to be able to do it in the sauna, be able to do it in your living room or his living room, depending on where you are. Yeah, not to pry, not to ask, but just tell your truth. And I think that'll make a huge difference.
Absolutely. You know, and I think it also goes even broader than that. I interviewed a guest previously around HIV, and she's a middle-aged straight woman. And a big part of her story was not knowing that she could catch it and that it was still a threat. You know, she thought of it as something in the past and something that didn't affect straight women. Then was confronted with, okay, now I've got this diagnosis and I know nothing about how to keep myself safe and keep those around me safe. Much like with yourself, the, you know, lovely upswing of that story was her getting to find out how safe she can live and how much support there is.
It's interesting how so many new diagnoses on the planet are straight people. They've caught up with us now at 50-50. And at the same time, there's a deafening silence about HIV. Like you said, most women don't even realize that they can be exposed to HIV. And most women who become HIV positive find out that they are because they're pregnant. Because the only time that they're tested for HIV is when they become pregnant, when that's when it's suggested that they should be tested. And it's a traumatic thing to go through when you're a new mom.
Thank you so much for your time. If people want to find your work, the documentary can be accessed via the Irish Film Institute. One catch with that for some of our international listeners is you do have to be resident here in order to access that. but I have previously been sponsored by ExpressVPN, so maybe give them a try. Also, your podcast can be accessed all over the world. It's really brilliant. You've had some wonderful guests, including Miss Peppermint, who's also been on this podcast, and you're there every Wednesday in the George. Anything else to plug?
No, that's it for now. We're off to Sydney World Pride in a couple of weeks. So that's our next adventure. We're staying there for a month, myself and Robbie. And we're guests of the Irish Consulate and the Sydney Queer Irish. And we're going to be making a whole season of our podcast, a Sydney season, while we're there. So that's one to watch out for.
That's very exciting. Also, fun fact for you, this podcast is currently featured in Australia and New Zealand as one of Apple Podcast picks for the new year. So there you go. So we have, surprisingly, we have a whole new influx of listeners in that part of the world. So welcome if that's you listening. For now, thank you. We'll wrap up there.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember,
you are enough. Good, yeah.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.